The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. We're coming up on the 60th anniversary of the pill, or what we more formally refer to as the oral contraceptive pill, which was first introduced in 1960. Millions and millions of women have used oral contraceptives, mainly to avoid becoming pregnant, but also for other medical reasons like endometriosis or abnormal menstrual cycles. The social impact of the pill cannot be overstated. It and other forms of birth control have helped women move toward parity and equality in the workplace, though we still have a long way to go. With many decades of use, we know many of the medical risks and benefits of the pill. For example, it's protective against ovarian or uterine cancer, but confers a small but significant added risk for thromboembolic events, things like blood clots in the legs or lungs or strokes. But what about the longer-term effects of the pill on health, including its effect on mental health, sex drive, stress response, or cognitive function? My guest today does an excellent job of addressing these longer-term questions and cataloging the need for further research in a new book titled This Is Your Brain on Birth Control: The Surprising Science of Women, Hormones, and the Law of Unintended Consequences. Dr. Sarah Hill is an evolutionary psychologist and professor of psychology at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth. Hill credits her use of the pill with her own ability to achieve a doctorate and career success, but found a different version of herself when she went off the pill, which was part of the inspiration for her book. Dr. Sarah Hill, author of This Is Your Brain on Birth Control, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Sarah Hill, welcome to Medical Monday. Congratulations on your new book. Many women, particularly younger women, will use oral contraceptives both as a means of birth control, but also like to help with skin care or acne, for example. And something that you taught me, you went through in one of the chapters. First, let's just go over the very basic of the physiology and pharmacology. So oral contraceptives really consist of two hormones. So remind us of that, and then I'll ask you about skin and other things.
Sure. So, most oral contraceptives or most sort of hormonal contraceptives that people go on are combination products. And so these are products that contain an artificial estrogen, which is usually ethanol estradiol, and then an artificial progesterone, which is called a progestin. There are some progestin-only products that are out there, but the majority of things that people will go on have both of these hormones. And even though most products that are out there use the same type of artificial estrogen, which again is this ethanol estradiol, there are more than 10 different types of progestins out there, and they're actually categorized into these different sort of families, or they call them different generations of progestins. And each one is sort of modified. It's like it has its own set of qualities that sort of set it apart from the other generations of progestins. And most of these progestins, all but one fourth-generation progestin, are actually created out of testosterone, which is something that is oftentimes surprising to people. But, you know, the explanation that's been provided for why this is that progesterone has some structural qualities that make it difficult to use in medication, and so it's sort of structurally difficult to isolate and use in pill form. And so what chemists have done is they've structurally modified testosterone in such a way that it's able to stimulate progesterone receptors and get the brain. So it's read by the body, similarly to progesterone. And so the way that this works in terms of preventing pregnancy is during the second half of a woman's menstrual cycle. So, you know, when we think about a typically cycling woman, her menstrual cycle can sort of be broadly divided into two halves. There's the first half, which we call the follicular phase, which is prior to ovulation, and it's when the body is doing all of the things that bodies do to get an egg to mature, and then waiting for the egg to be released, which is, of course, how the miracle of life sort of begins. And then there's a second half of the cycle, and that's everything that goes on after an egg has been released. And during this time, the body's in wait-and-see mode, right? And so it's just like sitting around your brain and your ovaries and, you know, everything else that's related to reproduction are just kind of standing by to see whether or not that egg that was just released is going to get fertilized and implanted. And during the second half of the cycle, the sex hormone progesterone is the dominant sex hormone. And this is actually how the pill kind of does its black magic, is you take this, you know, this pill every day, and it has a little bit of estrogen in it, and then, you know, these progestins. And so it sort of reads to the brain like you are at the phase in your cycle when you're waiting to see whether or not an egg is going to be fertilized. And during that period, the brain sort of shuts down the hormonal cascade that leads to the maturing of an egg and the release of an egg. And this is actually how you end up not getting pregnant, is your brain is getting this message that it's in the second half of the luteal phase of the menstrual cycle, and so it's not doing anything to try to lead an egg to mature and so on and so forth. And so that's how it all works. It actually works on the brain, and the brain then doesn't release the precursor hormones that need to get released in order to initiate egg development and uterine lining proliferation.
And you do a great job in the book of really taking the reader through the physiology of it and explaining it in kind of a fun way, which was refreshing because it was sort of like painfully remembering those med school days. But it's this cascade, as you said, of biochemicals that start in the hypothalamus and then go to the pituitary, which then releases its hormones that go to the ovaries. In the case of females, that get either the egg ready or like the uterine lining receptive to if there is a fertilized egg. And of course, if you're on oral contraceptive, that doesn't happen. And in fact, ovulation doesn't occur. But what's great about the book is it's really a compendium of research that both you've done and you've compiled from other investigators that really shows some of maybe the unanticipated or just different effects specifically on the brain and how oral contraceptives may or may not impact, you know, women differently in terms of coupling behavior, sexual response, as well as, you know, things that aren't even related to sex, but like the stress response. Tell us about what you found about women on oral contraceptives and what happens with, for example, libido or sex drive.
Yeah, so there's a lot of research now that's demonstrated that for some women, going on the birth control pill can really be associated with some really negative effects on sex drive. And so it can really sort of, you know, be, I call it in my book, sexual anti-venom. It just kind of can kill your libido. And the reason for this, you know, there's a couple of reasons for this. But, you know, when you think about or when you look at the research of what contributes to feelings of sexual arousal, sexual desire, and then the sexual response, so actual sexual responsiveness in the moment. The two hormones that really contribute to all of these wonderful things that women want to have more of in their lives are estrogen and testosterone. So we know that, you know, naturally cycling women, so women who are not on oral contraceptives, that at points during their menstrual cycle, when estrogen is the dominant hormone, that they report, you know, having more sexual fantasies, having more sexual desire, being more interested in sex, and they actually have more sex during this part in their cycle relative to during the second half or the luteal phase of the cycle. And so we know that estrogen sort of fuels sexual desire. It also fuels women's own feelings of femininity and sexiness, which also contributes to women's sort of sexual desire and their sexual response. And so we know that estrogen contributes to these feelings. And of course, the way that the pill works, as you know, we just talked about, is it keeps women's own levels of estrogen very low because an egg follicle, you know, isn't being stimulated and maturing an egg, and that's what precedes the release of large amounts of estrogen. So women's own levels of estrogen are kept very low, and then the artificial hormones in the birth control pill are progestin dominant. And so when estrogen is being overwhelmed by progesterone or these progestins, that is not a facilitator of sexual behavior. It's actually, it has the opposite effect. So there's research linking progesterone to lack of sexual desire. And so, you know, when you take these pills, it's keeping your estrogen levels low. The artificial hormones mimic a time that doesn't fuel sexual desire, and that's like one piece of the puzzle. But another piece of the puzzle is what happens to testosterone. And this is another motivator of sexual behavior, and in particular, sexual responsiveness of women. You know, even though we tend to think of it as being like a guy thing, it's not really a guy thing. It's a sex thing, and it's a you know, sort of competition thing. It's a lot of things. You know, it's something that influences women's sexual desire and sexual responsiveness. And what the research finds is that when women are on the pill, that it increases levels of these binding globulins, which is like the ugliest word. It's like the ugliest word globulin.
Yeah.
But it increases these binding globulins. And what they do is they actually bind to testosterone that women have, and it makes it inactive. So what this does is, you know, it basically saps women's sexual motivation by binding to the levels of testosterone that they have in their body and making it so it can't do anything. So this sort of combination of low testosterone, low estrogen, is something that is not a great facilitator of sexual behavior. And there is a lot of research indicating that women who are on the pill have, you know, less sexual desire. They tend to have more problems with sexual functioning in terms of being able to experience the normal sexual arousal response. And, you know, so that's like the sort of downside to the pill in terms of sexual desire. But like on the other side, you know, women who are on the pill do have more sex, and it's because they don't have to worry about pregnancy. You know, so there's, you know, it's kind of something that kind of goes both ways in some ways. It can be really negative in terms of sexual functioning and the desire for sex, but they do, you know, there is research showing that women, for example, who are on the birth control pill will have, you know, more partners. And that, you know, sort of goes to show that, you know, it can have these sort of almost paradoxical effects on women's sexual behavior and sexual functioning.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Sarah Hill, who's an evolutionary psychologist and a professor of psychology at TCU, Texas Christian University in Fort Worth. She's the author of the new book, This Is Your Brain on Birth Control, Surprising Science of Women, Hormones, and the Law of Unintended Consequences. And Dr. Sarah Hill, I think it's worth reminding our listeners that you made this point, but I just wanted to highlight it, which is that we tend to think of testosterone as a male hormone and estrogen as a female hormone, but all humans, men and women, men have testosterone and estrogen, but just in different ratios, and women, of course, have estrogen and testosterone, but in different ratios. So we all have all of those hormones, and so it's really the balance and ratio of these hormones that affect everything from our phenotype, like how we wind up as male or female or anywhere on the intersex spectrum, and then things like, as we've talked about, sexual desire and libido. I'm wondering if you would share with us some of the other surprising findings. For example, you highlighted some research that was surprising to me just about how women's sex drive can certainly impact their partner selection. And, you know, so oral contraceptives can certainly have a role here, depending on where women are in their cycle or whether they're, in a sense, physiologically speaking, fertile or not. And so when you're on oral contraceptives, one thing that's reduced is your fertility. Hence, you know, the whole reason women may be taking birth control pills is to prevent unplanned pregnancy. But that can have an effect on fertility, which in turn, you know, can affect sex drive, as we talked about, for many people on them, not everybody, but for others. So what were some of these experiments that you wrote about?
Yeah, so there's been a research now for several decades linking, you know, points in the menstrual cycle when women are fertile, which is, again, this is a period during the cycle when estrogen is the dominant sex hormone, and that finds that the estrogen-dominant parts of the cycle are during times when fertility is high, that women tend to report an increased sort of attunement to cues that have historically, you know, that we find sexy in men. So these are cues that have historically been linked to the male sex hormone testosterone. And so there's been, you know, lots of research over the last 30 years or so showing that estrogen sort of loves testosterone, right? And so when women have estrogen levels that are relatively high, they tend to place a sort of high priority on qualities in men, like having a nice strong jaw, broad shoulders, narrow waist, having, you know, sort of a masculinized jaw ridge, deeper set eyes, some of these cues that are sort of linked with masculinity and also, you know, what our brains perceive as sexy, right? Because, of course, sexy is like not something that actually exists. It's just really a product of our brain, rewarding our brain for seeing some types of qualities and not others. And so, you know, these qualities that we tend to think of as sexy in men tend to be really sort of prioritized in terms of partner choice and just who women report feeling attracted to at points in the cycle when estrogen's high. And so this sort of laid the groundwork for future research where researchers said, well, you know, if it's true that during points in the cycle when fertility is high and estrogen is high, that women are really emphasizing qualities that are associated with masculinity, is it possible that when women go on the pill, that it might actually lead them to prefer slightly more feminine male faces and even choose as partners, you know, partners who are more feminine and sort of less sexy than naturally cycling women. And so lo and behold, there's been research that's done on this now, and this is still research that's ongoing. There's labs that are publishing new papers on this as we speak. I just reviewed one, in fact, looking at, you know, do women who choose their partners in the pill, do they choose different types of qualities in their partners than naturally cycling women? And what they find is that they do. So women who choose their partners when they're on the pill, if you compare their faces, those men's faces, to the partners that were chosen by women who are not on the pill, and this is something that was just done by a random sample, what they found was that the women who were on the pill had chosen partners with more feminine male faces than the naturally cycling women. Other research has found that women who choose their partners when they were on the pill report having more satisfaction with their partner's financial provisioning ability and more satisfaction with their partner's intelligence than women who chose their partners when they're naturally cycling. But they have lower levels of sexual attraction to their partner, lower levels of sexual satisfaction, and, you know, just lower levels of sexual pretty much everything than the women who chose their partners when they're naturally cycling. And so what all of this is really kind of telling us is that, you know, when women are on the pill, it may nudge their priorities in their partner choice in ways that sort of de-emphasize the importance of, you know, things that historically have been linked with masculinity and sort of sexiness, and nudge them toward a preference for other qualities, possibly, you know, placing a greater emphasis on things like provisioning ability. And since that time, there's been some other research that's looked at, you know, what happens to women's relationships if they choose their partner when they're on the pill and then go off of it, right? Because this is the possibility, you know, here's where the possibility for some conflict potentially lies. And so researchers have also begun exploring this idea and looking at how women's satisfaction, you know, in terms of their sexual attraction to their partner and their satisfaction with their relationships changes if they chose their partner when they were on the birth control pill and then they go off of it. And what this research found actually is really consistent with some of the theoretical reasons that the researchers were proposing that this would go on in the first place. And that is that, you know, women seem to be de-emphasizing sexiness when they're choosing their partners on the pill. And so what this research found was that, you know, when women who chose their partners when they were on the pill go off of it, they do experience changes in relationship satisfaction and sexual satisfaction and attraction to their partners. But whether this becomes better or worse depends on how attractive their partner is. And what they find is that women who have attractive partners, if they go off the pill, they report being more attracted to their partner, more sexually satisfied, and more satisfied with their relationship in general than they were prior to going off of the pill. But for women who are partnered with less attractive partners, they report being less attracted to their partner, less sexually satisfied, and having lower levels of relationship satisfaction than they did prior to going off of this. And this is very provocative research, obviously, given that many women meet their partners when they're on the pill. And we need more research to sort of see how this all shakes out once it's being tested in some larger samples. But it goes to show you the pervasive role of women's sex hormones in terms of influencing, you know, processes not only related to, like, sex and what's going on with their eggs, but even things like attraction and partner choice.
Yeah, and I think this is where it's worthwhile to highlight the fact that you're a psychologist, and in fact, an evolutionary psychologist. So you put a lot of this into the context of human evolution. And so you have, what I like about the book is you have some funny theories, hypotheses that aren't just yours, but I mean in the field, that look at, you know, some of this in sort of caveman type behavior or hunter-gatherer. And you talked about provision, you know, stereotypically, I guess, a male partner or husband or whomever providing for the female, and leads to some interesting theories, to say the least. I was curious about how you got involved in this field altogether, or why psychology or evolution, or how you wound up studying a great deal about a women's reproductive physiology or the oral contraceptive.
Yeah, well, so I actually, you know, I've spent the last 15 plus years studying women, health and sexual relationships. So I went into the field of evolutionary psychology after I was actually a major in anthropology as an undergraduate with an emphasis on evolutionary sciences. And it wasn't until my senior year in college when I sort of had the epiphany, the aha moment, where I realized that you could actually use evolutionary principles not only to understand like the shape of our teeth and like our hand, but that, you know, evolution doesn't stop at the neck, and that we can also, you know, use it to understand behavioral predispositions that people have. And then I became like totally hooked on the idea of using evolutionary principles to really understand, you know, human nature and like why we are the way that we are. And within the field, you know, there hadn't been a whole lot of study on sort of female-specific psychology. And, you know, and a lot of this is just that there's mostly men in the field. It's changing, of course, just like a lot of research fields are changing, in part because of the birth control pill, allowing women to stay non-pregnant while they're in these, you know, grueling PhD programs. But so I became really interested in using these principles to better understand the way that women regulate their mating strategies and their reproductive behaviors, and then also the way that, you know, early life, I'm interested in something that I know that you also have looked at a lot on your show, is, you know, things related to the effects of early life environments and how they influence health. And so I've been, you know, really interested in understanding, you know, the way that early life poverty influences sort of health in ways that would help promote survival in harsh environments, but then also, you know, the way that women sort of experience the world, and what are some of the cues that we respond to that modulate whether we are monogamous or not, and some of these issues that really have been ignored by research for a long time. And so that was sort of my background when I came into this, and I was on the pill for more than a decade, and I write about this in my book. And, you know, so I'd been going through my life studying women and studying, you know, sort of the biological forces that lead us to make the decisions that we make. And I'd even published some papers on the effects of women's sex hormones on decision making. But it never, like, never crossed my mind that my oral contraceptives, which contain sex hormones, would be influencing what my brain was doing. And this was like a huge blind spot that I had. Because I've been, you know, I've been studying this stuff. Like, if you ask me any day of the week, like, do women's sex hormones influence what their brains are doing? I'd say, well, yeah, of course, in like all of these different ways. They influence this, 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 and this. And then, you know, well, what do you think about your birth control pill? Oh, it's great. My skin looks amazing. Like, I never thought about the two things sort of together until I went off of the pill and started feeling like a different version of myself. I started to feel like the version of myself that I was a decade prior to going on it. And that was, you know, sort of part of what led me to have this epiphany that, oh my gosh, you know, you've had a huge blind spot when it came to your pill, like, because sex hormones influence so many different processes, even things that have nothing to do with sex. Like in the book, for example, I talk about the way that they influence things like mood and the stress response even. And I just hadn't figured that out. And so that led me to the literature to see what psychology knew about the effects of the pill in terms of psychological functioning, because you're a physician, so you know how this is. Like, most of the conversation that women have with their doctors about the pill is about things like the risk of venothrombosis or the risk of stroke and sort of the bits and pieces in terms of risks, you know, that we might experience to our cardiovascular system. But we don't have these discussions about what, like, goes on to the brain and, like, what goes on with women and like who they are. And so I found out there was quite a bit of research on this stuff, but there was also a lot of questions that got raised that we don't have research on yet. And so I wanted to bring all of this information and make it available to women so that way, you know, they can know what we currently know about the way that the pill influences the brain, but also know what questions we need to be demanding answers for, because there's a lot of things that surround issues of the pill in the brain that we don't yet know, that we really do need to push for more research to answer, because I think that finding out the answer to some of these questions is going to really influence how women strategize their birth control use, especially, you know, over the lifetime and in adolescence, for example, when the brain is still developing.
Well, so one of those effects that you alluded to, really, is that an effect that an unanticipated effect, perhaps, but now that it's been studied for a longer period of time, is that oral contraceptives seem to blunt the stress response. And the way that they do that is by essentially lowering the amount of cortisol the body produces, which is a stress hormone produced by the adrenal glands. And when we think about fight or flight response, cortisol is something that's produced to help the body cope with that, to help it produce glucose for energy. You know, you think about also like adrenaline, which is epinephrine, which, you know, really opens up the lung passages, for example, if you're truly like running from a tiger or something like that. But so what effect might this have for women's stress response? But when we're talking too about the whole idea about interactions with children or trauma or because it was really interesting to me.
Yeah, this really fascinated me. And this research, I found it kind of piecemeal because half of the research that I found on this was a footnote to other research. So it was research on the stress response where the researchers just sort of noted as a side note, oh, by the way, pill-taking women don't exhibit this response at all, and so we've had to throw them out of the sample. And, you know, so there was a lot of research showing that women who are on the birth control pill don't have a cortisol response to stress. And it was a matter of, like, trying to figure out why that was going on. And so one of the things that I had to do in the process of writing this book was I felt a little bit like Encyclopedia Brown, where I was like putting together all these clues and trying to figure out like what was going on with women's cortisol response. And I was kind of laying out all of the pieces and trying to sort of solve a puzzle. And what became very clear when you look at the way that the stress response is modified in pill-taking women is that it seems as if something in the birth control pill is causing women's stress response to go through the roof and actually leading the stress response to shut itself down. And, you know, there's been research now showing that pill-taking women's stress response and some of these biological markers that are associated with exposure to chronic stress and trauma and things like PTSD, women who are on the birth control pill seem to have several biological markers of exposure to chronic stress. Including having shrunken hippocampi. So when you look at trauma victims and people who have PTSD, one of the ways that the illness manifests itself is in having a shrunken hippocampus. And this is an area of the brain, by the way, that's responsible for things like learning and memory. It also plays a role in our ability to like remember space, like to be able to navigate our way through the world. But the hippocampus has more receptors for cortisol than probably any other area of the brain. And so it's really sensitive to the effects of cortisol. And cortisol is good in small doses, like you talked about. When you're stressed out and running, you know, if you have to run away from a bear, cortisol is doing all the things to help facilitate that sort of a response. It dumps sugar and fat into your bloodstream to allow you to make a hasty getaway. It increases your perceptual vigilance. That way you're paying attention to things. And it helps to filter things from your short-term into your long-term memory. So that way you can remember the stressful things that are going on. So that way later on, you're better able to cope with them. And it helps you, your body actually deal with and manage and cope with the stressor. But when you have too much of that going on, too much cortisol, because it's basically taking energy from everything else the body normally does, so things like cell repair, fueling immunological responses, just like regular metabolism, like day-to-day activities, because cortisol takes energy from your day-to-day bodily repair activities and dumps them all into managing a stress response, your body will shut the stress response down if it goes on for too long because it can't do that. It becomes really damaging to the body if there's too much of it. And so what seems to be going on with pill-taking women is that they're experiencing some sort of surge in cortisol activity during their pill usage, and it's causing the cortisol response to actually turn itself off. So there's a lot of questions that need to be answered now about what's going on with the birth control pill and the cortisol response.
Dr. Sarah Hill, thank you so much for joining us. It was great to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.